Harry Holzer is a professor of public policy at Georgetown University. He's widely considered one of the country's leading authorities on what works and what doesn't work in workforce training. He formerly served as chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor. He currently is a national fellow at Harvard University. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute and also at the Urban Institute. And he's an affiliate of the Institute for Research on Poverty here at UW-Madison. He's published 27 scientific articles, 44 working papers on a range of workforce development issues, such as the low-wage labor market, particularly in urban areas. Recently, he's focused on employers, the skills that they need, the hiring practices that they use, and the effects that this has on the job prospects of the disadvantaged. On a personal note, Dr. Holzer tells me that he grew up on a poultry farm in Vermont. He and his wife have three daughters, age 14, 9, and 9. Yes, you heard me right. He has twin daughters. So his topic today is workforce training, what works, and who benefits. Let's give a warm Wisconsin welcome to Dr. Harry Holzer.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you for inviting me and organizing all this. Thank you to all of you for coming. One correction to Karen's remarks, I actually didn't grow up in Vermont on a farm. I grew up in New Jersey on a farm. Back in a time when there actually were poultry farms in New Jersey. I don't want to impugn the reputation of Vermont by suggesting that I'm one of their native children. So just thought I'd get that correct. This is always the part that I'm most nervous about, is making sure I can work these things. You know, technological change disadvantages unskilled workers like me. There we go. Okay. So I think my role here today is to sort of lead off and give a broad introduction to this issue of what works and what doesn't work in the area of workforce development. So I thought I'd focus in on three areas. First of all, just a quick look at the labor market. What's the labor market generating? What does the demand side look like in terms of the demand for skills? And how does the supply of skills among workers match up to that, both at the middle skill level, and I'll define that in a few minutes, and at the high end? Secondly, what do effective policies look like? What would the ideal look like, both in terms of policies and programs and a system versus the reality, which is quite far away from that ideal? And what do we know about approaches that have been proven by rigorous research or that at least look promising in the base of some data we have? And then how might we go forward? I'll say a little bit about federal policy, a little about state policy over the short term and the longer term. I'll say right now I'm mostly going to focus on long-term issues, the long-term trends in demand for skills and workforce programs. I'm not going to focus a lot on the severe downturn that we're all experiencing right now. I know that's on your minds, as well it should be. I'll say a few things about that, and I'm sure we'll circle back to that during the Q&A session. But in terms of training, we do want to keep at least one of our eyes on the long ball and on long-term trends, because ultimately that's really where the returns to training are. So going forward, let me just say a little about the demand side of the economy. I mean, there are these stereotypes floating around in the population, one notion that good-paying jobs are disappearing from America. Of course, that's simply not true. I mean, good-paying jobs are here in great multitude, in vast numbers. The problem is they simply require more education and training than they used to. And the vast majority of any that might be called good-paying jobs do require something beyond secondary, some kind of certificate, some kind of training of some type. Another notion you hear is that we're developing an hourglass economy or a dumbbell labor market. Big demand for PhDs in engineering, big demand for childcare, not a lot in between. That's simply not true. There was a little bit of shrinkage in the middle in the 1990s, only during the 1990s, so not during the 80s, not during the most recent decade, a little bit of shrinkage. There remains a very substantial middle skill part of the economy that's very important, especially for our disadvantaged youth and adults, to be trained for, to meet that demand. And of course, these are some of the key sectors that have generated those jobs: healthcare, construction, manufacturing, a range of areas in the service sector. Now, again, I know some of these are the sectors that got hit hardest by the downturn. Construction and manufacturing has not been a big job creator, a big source of demand for labor in the last couple of years. I think they will recover over time, albeit slowly. And it's important, again, to make sure we have skilled people available for those positions as they slowly come back. And, of course, the push for green jobs, which I know Dan Kamen is going to talk about, and infrastructure spending will help to bolster demand in those sectors and will nurture that recovery process, at least to some extent. But these are really the jobs, the kinds of jobs I'm talking about in a wide range of sectors, construction and engineering, but also in healthcare. And, of course, healthcare is the one sector where demand has not abated during the downturn. And given the demographic trends we're looking at, it will continue to be a strong source of jobs, even in manufacturing, even in a range of legal and other services, a wide range of jobs that pay quite well, where demand traditionally has been strong, and where employers report some difficulty meeting that demand. And the one I'll point out to you is that even in 2009, there was an article in the New York Times by Louis Chatel saying that manufacturers all over the country having trouble finding welders. Welders were in short supply even in the middle of a massive downturn despite cutbacks. So even when overall demand is declining, you have shortages in certain key areas, not rocket science jobs, not PhD in engineering jobs, but middle-skilled jobs, for which we need to do a better job of training. This is what the numbers look like. These are BLS occupational projections. I haven't updated. The numbers are actually now available through 2018. They look exactly the same as these. I took the occupation, so I listed the high occupations, the high demand, which usually require college or more. Those are mostly professional and managerial jobs. The low end is sort of the low-end service jobs that don't have a lot of skill requirements. The middle-skill jobs are all occupations that fall in between that usually require something beyond high school. You know, about a third of the jobs are at the high end, a little under a quarter at the low end, 40 to 50% consistently in that middle. And we see little change in those numbers. It doesn't look like a dumbbell to me or an hourglass, a very substantial middle sector for which we need to keep training people. So if this is what the demand side looks like, again, over time, over the long term, with 75 to 80% of jobs either in the middle or high skill area requiring some post-secondary to get a good paying job, what does the supply side look like? And I'm not going to focus on the whole labor force. I'm going to focus on young people today aged roughly 25 to 29, most of whom have completed their schooling, so it gives you a pretty good indication of where they're ending up. It's a little bit of an apples and oranges comparison because this is based on years of education, not on occupational training. So I don't want to overstate, but just to give you some sense of where we're going on this, a quarter of our young people are still dropping out of high school nationwide. That's a disgrace. And there's very little in our economy for those folks. But another quarter graduate high school, and at least early on, don't start any post-secondary. So that's fully half of our young people coming out at that time not getting any active preparation for good middle or upper skill jobs. Of course, lots of folks do go to community college, and again, especially right now during the downturn, but we have very high rates of non-completion. A lot of folks don't complete anything in community college, not even an occupational certificate, much less an associate's degree. And of course, once they drop out or once they're done with that formal schooling, for most folks in the lower to middle end of the educational range, there's quite little formal and informal on-job training that occurs. Now, economists are always puzzled by this. How can it be that the incentives in the labor market to get more education and training are so high right now, and yet so few people are doing it, according to these numbers? And we've come up with a lot of different answers. People simply don't have the basic skills to succeed in post-secondary when they come up, because early on they haven't gotten the right training. The costs of higher ed growing, the motivation and the information about how you get it and the need for that post-secondary isn't there for a lot of these young people. And of course, for single parents who become single parents at early ages, family responsibilities often conflict. So it's something of each of these stories. You add them all together and a lot of people simply aren't getting the education they need, education or training, to succeed in this economy. And if you think there is some imbalance, now again, I don't want to overstate the imbalance. I am an economist. Labor markets do clear. We don't have permanent surpluses and shortages. You know, it's not like we have these square pegs and trying to fit into these round holes. The labor market does clear. It just clears in a way that's not very appealing to most of us, with quite low wages and salaries for people in that lower to middle range if they don't have the jobs, and increasingly high wages and salaries for people at the high end. And this underlying imbalance, I think, will grow because the baby boomers are going to retire. I have a question mark there, maybe a little more slowly than we thought a year or two ago based on what's happened to our 401ks, but many of us are going to retire within the next decade, and we will largely be replaced by immigrants who are mostly, there's a high-end group of immigrants and a low-end. The low-end group is a lot bigger. So on average, when immigrants replace the baby boomers in the labor market, that's going to flatten out rates of educational attainment. Let me show you another graph here, prepared from an Aspen Institute report from about 6 years ago, comparing the last two decades of the 20th century to the first two decades of the 21st century, based on projections on educational attainment for different groups and retirement ages. What you had in the last two decades of the 20th century was the baby boomers replacing older cohorts of workers who were less educated. So overall, you see there was a fairly big drop in the fraction of workers with high school or less, and fairly substantial growth in the fractions with some college or a full college diploma. You fast forward to the first two decades of the 21st century, that's not happening, right? If the immigrants are mostly replacing the baby boomers, you have a great flattening. You don't see a big decline in the fraction of high school or less, and you certainly don't see much increase either in the middle skills area, the some college area, or at the top end. So if the demand for skills keeps rising, but the supply is projected to flatten out, that imbalance I talked about will likely grow. And of course, the results will be what we know. Continuing poverty for the disadvantaged, for people without the skills, growing inequality between the people who have those skills and those don't, and difficulty for employers to find skilled workers to fill jobs, even with moderate skill needs. And again, I mentioned the welder example before, of areas where these are not long-term shortages, but it's tightness that employers experience at a point in time that can be disruptive to them, and that does create opportunity for people who go out and get the skills. So what would an effective education and workforce system look like? And this is sort of, in some sense, the key slide in the presentation. Broadly, I think three things are important, and they all have to come together to make all this work. In a system, we need not just individual effective programs and policies. You want a system that works, that brings together education and the workforce side. Well, we need improved secondary and post-secondary options for young people, a wide range of effective options for them to choose from. And I do say secondary. If we don't get secondary right, you're not going to get post-secondary right. And we ignore secondary too much in these discussions. I'll come back to that. But then it's important for there to be better alignment between the education and training that goes on and the demand side of the labor market, between where these good jobs are, where the growing sectors of the labor market are, where there's some unmet need. And finally, there's a range of supports and services that are needed to help that process occur, and to help especially disadvantaged folks get through the education system and into the jobs that they need. What you often need is a fourth component, some intermediary, to pull all these three pieces together and make them work effectively. But let me say something about each of those three items. Post-secondary education. First of all, you gotta get the secondary options right. We have these enormous dropout rates we have to bring down. But aside from that, what we need is really a multiple range of upward pathways. Some of them directly into post-secondary, some into good jobs in the labor market right away. Presumably people are gonna have combinations of work and schooling in their lives that we can prepare them for. So we need to strengthen the academic and college prep piece, but at the same time, we've let high quality career and technical education deteriorate in this country, and I think that's been a great tragedy. The old stereotype of voc ed, which was a reality in a lot of cases. That's not what we have in mind now. We're talking about high quality career and technical options, where I think Wisconsin, with its technical college system, has actually been a leader in the country. And we need to strengthen the start for that, not either or, not academic or career and technical, but a strong academic base for those who choose the career and technical, and the career academies and some other options I'll mention again in a few minutes. Then, the whole range of post-secondary options, community and technical colleges, proprietary schools, four-year colleges, the whole range of providers, and making sure that disadvantaged folks have what they need to get through those schools. It's important not just to be thinking of associate's degrees and four-year degrees. There are occupational certificates that pay quite well in these technical fields at the community colleges and technical colleges, and an economist named Lou Jacobson has done some very important work recently documenting. Not all of these certificates pay well, but certainly some of them do, and we need to have greater awareness and greater information about the ones that pay well and try to steer more students into them. But the issue of alignment with the demand side of the labor market then becomes very important. Sometimes people say, should we be focusing on broad general skills or more narrowly tailored specific skills specific to some sector? And of course, the answer is we need some of both. I mean, employers are looking for workers with this broad range of skills, analytical skills, thinking abilities, communication abilities. You don't want people going forward that don't have those. And demand can shift over time. We don't want to prepare people for one sector where that sector's demand might disappear in 5 or 10 years. So it needs to be a broad base, combine the occupational training with good academics that can enable people to adjust over time to shifts in the market. And we have some good models of that. Sectoral training models, and I know Larry Good will talk about career pathways, incumbent worker training. These are all models that I think effectively combine good, solid training with occupational needs that have been, for which there's strong research evidence. But I think we need more. I'm going to come back to this issue. Trainees, community college students, need to have better information about what's going on in the labor market when they're picking their course curricula and their majors. A lot of young students in community college have no clue about how the labor market works and what's rewarded out there. And we haven't built systems that provide them with that information. And we need better incentives. You know, frankly, most states in the country, community colleges get the same reimbursement from the state if the student is taking nursing or some kind of technical field versus if they're taking music or pottery or something. We're not aligning the incentives within the system to build the capacity to train those people with needs of the labor market. And I think that needs to change as well. And of course, a whole range of supports and services are necessary to make all this work. Intermediaries are very important in this process to bring the pieces together to make sure that young people get the services they need, the information, the connections with employers, et cetera. Childcare and transportation, obviously very important. Stipends, financial aid, and a whole range of services, remediation services, counseling, that are often necessary at community college to get low-income folks through. And of course, finally, when they enter the labor market, for those people that haven't gotten better skills, a whole range of income and benefits supplements for low-skill workers and their families so that they have incentives to take low-wage jobs if they need them. So if that's my ideal, a system that provides strong secondary and post-secondary certification options aligned with demand and with supportive services, what's the reality look like? And we're pretty far away from that reality right now. First of all, the funding system is simply way too low coming out of the federal level. And there have been dramatic declines in funding for the Labor Department programs, the Education Department. And by the way, it looks like that's going to continue under the Obama administration budget for FY 2011. The Education Department has done much better in the last few years. I'm glad to see that. I think Pell Grants are very important. However, there needs to be an alignment with the labor market and the workforce system. Community college can't do it all on its own, and I think some of that imbalance needs to be redressed. But the system is very fragmented across many different dimensions. First of all, fragmented across agencies. In many, many places, the education agencies and the workforce agencies don't talk to each other very much, don't work together. That's the silos problem that we often hear about. Secondly, it's disjointed across geography, with workers in inner city areas or rural areas having little access to jobs in the suburbs. No way of getting there, no way of finding out about them. And the key participants, employers, are very frequently disconnected from the training system. Potential students and workers are disconnected from both of them. And there's very few institutional linkages bringing them together. And as I said, part of the systemic problem, the lack of information available to these students about what's going on, and the poor incentives that the institutions in the system face for bringing the pieces together. And finally, we have too little rigorous evidence on what works. And again, rigorous evidence of what's been proven, but even promising evidence that needs to be explored further. So I'm going to skip across a few of these slides to save time and go straight to this issue of what does the research show on what's effective and what's not, and where do we need more information. There's something I call the Heckman critique. There's an economist named Jim Heckman, who happens to have a Nobel Prize at the University of Chicago, and he's been very influential in policy circles in Washington and elsewhere, basically making the argument, none of this workforce stuff works. The only thing that works is investing in little kids, so his recommendation is kill off all the workforce stuff and take it all and invest it all in high-quality pre-K. Obviously, I don't share that. High-quality pre-K is very important. I think it's silly to present them as an either-or, right? They complement each other. You want some of both. But the truth is we do have mixed evidence on the cost-effectiveness of our workforce programs. If you look at the evidence, one size does not fit all. What seems to work, for instance, among adults for the working poor is quite different than what works for the hard-to-employ. What works for in-school youth at risk of dropping out may be quite different from what works from those who have already dropped out and who need to be reconnected. In general, we have evidence on little programs here and there that work, but not how you pull them together as a system. So we need more research evidence on that, as well as a lot more experimentation. We do have small successful programs, but we have difficulty figuring out how to replicate them and bringing them to scale. And too often, You see programs with short-term gains that seem to fade out. So these are all the problems that the research literature has generated, but we have learned some things. You know, we do have some base of knowledge on which to build. When you're looking at adults, we have different evidence for the working poor and the hard to employ. There's good, strong evidence on sectoral models by a few different studies, and this public-private venture study, one of its sites is the Wisconsin Regional Training Partnership, which comes out looking very strong in a rigorous random assignment study. So I think that's an important finding, and with some substantial scale as well. Other efforts integrating remedial into occupational training at the community college level. So many folks get stuck in remediation and then just drop out because they feel like they're not going anywhere. Very important to integrate so that right away people are motivated. They're getting the occupational stuff. And the IBEST program in Washington looks very promising as a model for doing that. And there's good evidence on intermediaries, temp agencies, other nonprofit intermediaries in terms of the success of bringing the piece together that I can talk about. There's lots of other approaches, by the way. New innovations in curriculum design in community colleges, stackable credentials, course modules that are easier. We just don't have any evidence on their importance and their success. So they're perhaps promising, but we need to see more about them. And of course, on the hard to employ, a very different set of approaches. Transitional jobs, which are expensive, but seem to have some success for these populations, and supplementing low earnings jobs with tax credits and other employment services seems to be effective in a lot of these studies. Of course, for in-school youth, a very different set of approaches. We want to reduce those dropout rates and give people successful upward pathways across different dimensions. There's some nice mentoring programs that seem to play that role that improve preparation and awareness of college. There's dual enrollment programs, I think, that have some promise. At the community college level, there's a program called Opening Doors, which has been heavily researched by an outfit named MDRC, that talk about things that seem to improve success at community colleges for the disadvantaged populations. A performance-based scholarship, where the scholarships are tied to performance as part of a broader financial aid package. The creation of learning communities, groups of students who come together and take classes together and learn from each other and support each other. Mandatory services, especially different kinds of counseling through the first year. There's evidence that all of them pay off and improve success rates and reduce these dropout rates in community colleges. And finally, as I sort of said, the career and technical education piece. The career academies are the most successful intervention for high-risk youth, especially high-risk young men, that we've ever seen. Strong earnings gains, reductions in dropout rates. They've been scaled up nationally. They don't seem to fade out over time. A huge success story that indicates what you can do with career and technical education at the secondary level when it's high quality. There's also some nice evidence on tech prep, which directly links kids in high school into community college courses, apprenticeships, some evidence on apprenticeships. So there are models of high-quality CTE that really seem to work and that we should be building on. Of course, for out-of-school youth, again, a very different population. These kids have already failed. And figuring out how to reconnect them to schools and to the labor market is a bigger challenge. Some nice evidence from these residential programs, like the Job Corps and the National Guard Challenge Program, but a question about whether they fade out over time. Service employment programs, Youth Build, the Service and Conservation Corps, some nice outcome evidence, and the challenge of reconnecting the dropouts to community colleges. The Gateways program is the most promising thing out there. Hasn't been rigorously evaluated, but again, an effort to find these young kids, get them at least to some kind of secondary credential, and immediately get them into some kind of community college track. And of course, I said it's important to build systems, not just isolated successful programs. A few nice examples of that, the Youth Opportunities Program from the Clinton years, 36 programs in low-income neighborhoods around the country that have been rigorously evaluated, that were quite successful, plus some other examples like the Philadelphia Youth Network, where they figured out how to create a system, how to pull together all the pieces and make sure that young people aren't falling through the cracks and coordinate all the different silos into a system that's operating effectively. Going forward, I think my time is relatively short. So at the federal level, we need to authorize the Workforce Investment Act, first of all, by putting more money into it, improving performance measures. But I think one thing that will occur, competitive grants to states to build these advancement systems, to experiment and evaluate and try to pull these pieces together into systems that really don't exist right now at both the state level and the metro level. So the federal government can do more to encourage that. And of course, the American Graduation Initiative that President Obama has was, I think that has a lot of promise as well, giving out a little over $1 billion a year and another set of competitive grants aimed at the community colleges to build curricula and supports and systemic changes and to have the research and evaluation to find out if these things are working. But really, I think the broader question is, what can states do in the meantime with some amount of federal support, not as much as some of us would like to see, but with some amount of federal support, some of their own resources, and the ability to leverage some greater support from the private sector. And again, if companies need these skills, and if they benefit from the training system, the question is how to get them to help pay, not just a free ride on the public resources going into training workers that the companies then benefit from. But I think things can do it be done at the state level. A lot of states are starting to do this anyway. First of all, simply looking more carefully at the data, at the demand side and the supply side, identifying the growing sectors with good-paying jobs for non-college workers, and building some successful career pathways for different levels of skill. And of course, the pathway for someone who barely finished high school is going to be really different than for someone who has finished an associate's degree or even a four-year degree. Creating the curriculum and supports at the community college level to sort of pull this off, but also trying to build the systems, building partnerships with the key industry members, the training providers, and the relevant agencies, so this operates as an effective system. And again, I think these federal grants programs, these competitive grants programs, will provide the seed money for that, but the hard lifting needs to be done at the state level, I think, to figure out how those systems work. The information on the labor market needs to be better. The incentives for the local community colleges and technical colleges to invest in capacity in the high demand areas has to be better. And we simply need to experiment a lot and evaluate a lot to get a better sense of what works and what doesn't. I'll be happy to talk more about the downturn. My time is up right now. It is a severe and persistent downturn, but it's actually a pretty good time to train people. A lot of people are flocking back. There are some nice opportunities in the recovery package for doing so. I think both my co-panelists are going to talk about that. So I'll stop here, and thank you very much for listening.
We're going to take 5 minutes of questions for Dr. Holzer, and we target our seminars to legislators and high-ranking state agency officials, so we want to give them priority in asking questions. Jennifer Soibert will come around with the mic. She's our very efficient seminar coordinator. And we do audio tape these for people who drive long distances to the Capitol, so we'd like you to ask your question into the microphone. Any questions for Dr. Holzer? Yes, Representative Townsend. Just a second here, wait for the mic.
You outlined some of the things. One, you talked about the remedial situation, and I think the key question is why are we graduating students from high school that end up needing remedial programs? The second thing is that you did not really address the issue of motivation. There's an old saying that you can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. The opportunities are there, but it seems to me that in many segments of our population, they lack motivation. Now, how do we address that issue?
Well, let me take the second one, because I think you're right on both those points at some level. Young people, ages of 16 to 18, and I have one of them at home, they're not the most forward-looking bunch in the world. And the notion that, you know, economists have these models that you kind of look out at potential returns and you make the investments that you need as an 18-year-old. I think there's a problem. There's a lot of different problems, but I think part of it is a lot of these young people are not informed about what skills are required and rewarded in the labor market. A lot of these people don't see people from their communities getting good jobs, people who look like them. If you're talking about low-income young men growing up in a lot of these poor neighbors, they don't see a lot of successful examples out there, and they don't see the jobs in their neighborhoods. Forget the high-end jobs. They don't see the middle-skilled jobs, the construction jobs, the successful electricians or plumbers or technicians. So part of their lack of motivation is they don't see the examples, and they don't see the opportunity. And I think part of it, and of course, too many of them, they fall so far behind. And the other question about why are we graduating kids, you know, the research evidence is showing now that so many young people, the day they set foot in kindergarten, they're already so far behind their peers, and those gaps only grow in, say, the K through 4 years. So it's very hard to remedy those in high school. Having said that, high school remains this area where everyone knows we need big reforms. We have a lot of questions about exactly what works. To me, the notion is a broader range of pathways. I think that will motivate young people. I think part of the reason the career academies work so well is that you have good quality instruction that's combined with real work experience. I think these young people, they go out in the labor market in the summertime and they get internships that they otherwise wouldn't have. All of a sudden, they're more motivated to work harder because they see the connection between what they're learning in high school and what works in the labor market. And so many young kids don't see that connection and therefore aren't motivated to do the job. I think making those connections clear would help.
Other questions for Dr. Holzer? Yes.
Thank you. I came to this last year, too, and the importance of early childhood education was driven to us quite strongly. Have you seen examples of states that have really taken an effort, and how did they do it to really improve early childhood education?
Well, there have been a number of states that have gone this route, and I think the most successful models have been Oklahoma probably has the most successful one, and especially the city of Tulsa has a program with huge impacts. Now, again, we don't know if they fade out or not, but at least in the short run, the Tulsa-Oklahoma, and that's been well studied by a couple of my colleagues, Bill Gormley, who used to be here at Wisconsin, and Ted Geyer, and the Georgia system, I think has generated some nice impacts. Now, these are universal systems. They're not targeted, and there's always this conflict between do you want a universal system or do you want to target your resources at, you know, there's always more political support for a more universal system, but within that, if you can target more towards those with greater need. So those are the two best systems. Other states have tried it as well that I think are not as far along. There's a study by Tom Cook and some co-authors, Vivian Wong, comparing five different states, and I think Oklahoma and Georgia come out looking pretty well compared to the other states of how to construct this system. And it is the disadvantaged within those universal systems that get the biggest early bumps.
Yes, one more question. Wait for the mic. Yeah.
First, Dr. Holzer, thank you for your great work for years. We all here in Wisconsin have been following all that you've been writing about and working on.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So with the president's new budget coming out and this trend you commented on of the shrinking federal support that we've seen, Department of Labor, over the years, but now the pressure that we're under, the reauthorization of WEA ahead of us, if you would comment on this move toward targeting some of what's been discretionary money for the states to now try and spark some of these innovations that the administration's putting forward, if you'd comment on that.
Well, so I think that's a positive thing. What I've seen in the proposal that came out this week, there's two innovation funds that the administration is proposing, one for adults and one for youth, with a kind of $100 to $150 million in each. I like the idea. Those resources are not enough, given, I think, the magnitude of the problem out there. So I'd like to see the resources bumped up. All the other funding, the rest of the formula money, remains pretty flat, even without adjusting for inflation. So I'm concerned about that. Now, so I like the idea of competitive grants to the states and to the regions, to the metropolitan areas, to try to bring demand and supply better together and to build these systems. The formula money, you have to strengthen the incentives for the states to use that money well. I think the performance measures in WEA have been a real mess right now. They're actually worse in WEA than they were in JTPA in a lot of ways. So I would like to see the performance measures improved, a lot more focus on long-term outcomes, statewide measures, if possible, rather than those for individual program participants, so the states don't cream about who they let in and who they don't. But if you improve the performance measures so states have better incentives to use the formula money, and then you complement that with a beefed-up competitive grants, I think that would be the right combination. And I would like to see more resources in the system to correct this growing imbalance.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.